Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated war history episodes. And we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, politicians, and historians to talk about wars in history. Today's guest is James Donovan. He is the author of several highly acclaimed historical books, including today's book, Nothing But Courage, The 82nd Airborne's Daring D-Day Mission and Their Heroic Charge Across the Lafayette Bridge. James, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I am very excited. I have to say, we had an episode a month ago or so, with our guest, Stephen Rabe, who came on and he wrote The Lost Paratroopers of Normandy, which is about the 82nd Airborne. And he had mentioned, that there were some guys who took over a bridge, but it wasn't really, that's not what the book was about. And my brain was always like, okay, but what happened with those guys? Like, was that? And your book is about that. And so All of these questions that maybe our listeners had and that I've had, we actually get to talk to you today about those things. So can you just give us a little overview of this insane true story of what this is?
A little background refresher course on D-Day, because this is part of D-Day. There were five beaches spread over 50 miles of Normandy coast, as I'm sure you know, and a lot of listeners and viewers. The westernmost two were the American ones, Omaha and Utah. Utah was the westernmost. They decided that to make that beach invasion successful at Utah, they needed to drop two divisions of airborne troops behind the beach, to keep the Germans from sending reinforcements to the beach before it got properly established. And to do that, take a few key crossroad little towns and villages and bridges. There were a couple of rivers.
No.
So the 101st was one of them. And of course, we've heard of them because Band of Brothers was in the 101st, that company. Mm-hmm. They were dropped right behind Utah Beach, 2-3 miles, and they were tasked with taking four exits off the beach through the sand and lots of marsh. The Germans had deliberately flooded this area, so these four exits, very narrow dirt roads and gravel roads, were very important in getting our troops off the beaches and into the inland. And also to keep the Germans from sending reinforcements in and, throwing our troops back into the sea. That was the 101st. The 82nd, which was actually given the tougher job because they had seen action before. No one in the 101st had. They were tasked with dropping about 5 to 7 miles inland and taking, again, a couple of small villages, a crossroad village, especially called Saint-Marie-Glise, which would be the first French town liberated in the invasion, and also a couple rivers that they needed to keep the Germans from sending reinforcements in. And also, they couldn't just destroy these bridges because we needed them to send our troops and armor westward off the beaches and to go straight west and cut off the Catentin Peninsula, where this was all happening, so the Germans couldn't send more troops into the peninsula. We could send troops north to Cherbourg, which had a great deep water port that we needed to help assist in the buildup of men and material and equipment. So that was the 82nd task.
I was going to ask, so that answers one of my questions was like, why not just blow up the bridge? Why fight it and take it? And so that's
right.
You're talking about supplies and stuff.
Sending, these were the only two bridges over this small, very narrow, gently flowing river called the Murderay, which flowed north to south into the Duvet River. And the Duvet, there were two bridges on the Duvet River, which were blown, but they didn't need those because they weren't going south there. But they needed the bridges over the Murderay to send it straight and cut off the Cotentin. And they needed bridges, solid bridges that could take armor, tanks, troop carriers, things like that. And those were the only two bridges over the Murderay.
This is a proper side quest of D-Day that was absolutely necessary. And all these small pieces were, and this is one of them.
Yeah. And
So just bring us through. So the Germans in World War One also, and in World War II, very famous for counter offenses. That's just something they're particularly known for, I guess. And so can you talk about why we needed to hold that bridge to keep off a counteroffense during D-Day and what was going on with that?
Well, you know your history, because Germans, right, in World War One and even in World War II, they were just known. They would, if you attacked them, there would be a counteroffensive very soon. It was textbook German strategy. And they dropped in the 82nd, 6,400 men, three regiments. The next day, a regiment of glider-borne infantry troops would land by glider. That's another crazy part of it.
Wow.
If you know your World War II history, that the only war in which they thought was a good idea to drop about 30 men in these mostly plywood gliders with no armor, no engine. They would just glide into, they called it a control crash. Well, that was mostly the next day, almost 2,000 glider-borne troops. But
terrifying
morning, just about starting at 1:51 a.m. British time, they started dropping. That went on for about 50 minutes. 6,400 men. Besides the obstacles they knew about, the Germans, there were about 12,000 Germans in the area, so they were dropping behind the lines and into the lines, German lines. The Germans were waiting for them because they knew Rommel, who controlled much of the defense of the Atlantic Wall, had told his men to look out for, be ready for airborne troops.
Yeah.
So the Germans were waiting for them. There were dozens of gun anti-aircraft flak emplacements all over the peninsula, right underneath their flight path. And nevertheless, most of them dropped without dying yet. But it was dark. They were in the Bocage country of this area of France, where these small, irregularly shaped farm fields were bordered by these very large hedgerows. Nobody had told them about these hedgerows. They'd be surrounded on each side by hedgerows, but they weren't the hedgerows that everybody thought that you see in America and England, where you could just kind of jump over one. Sure. These were hedgerows that had been growing for literally centuries.
Wow.
They had, become, they were large, sometimes 6 feet high, rock, dirt, trees growing 40, 50 feet high. So if you were in one, you could hardly hear anything outside this little field. It was perfect for defense.
Germans
set up a machine gun emplacement right behind a hedgerow aiming into, the field. So they didn't know about that. They didn't know about the Murderay
had
also been flooded. So it was a half a mile wide at places, just solid water, like almost 6 feet deep, 4 to 6 feet deep. A lot of men drowned. They fell into it. They didn't know about that. Nevertheless, they took Saint-Marie-Glise by 4 a.m. The two bridges, they didn't take them, and that would take, the final one at La Fère would take 3 days until D plus three on the morning of June 9th. They would, it would be a near suicidal attack straight across this narrow bridge and this 400 yard causeway that was on the other side of it to dry land. And of course, there were Germans on the other side in this little terrible Kinney, who with their mortars trained on the bridge and dozens of machine guns. So that happened 3 days later. It was necessary because the beachhead eventually became safe. They were moving men off the beach, and they had to move west to cut off the peninsula to move north and grab the port or shipboard.
Okay. And the jump, the night of the mission, right? Oh my God, the chaos, the horror. So they're in the dark, D-Day, like 2:30 in the morning or something like that.
Yeah.
And they got to jump into Nazi-occupied France. And it just, I keep picturing this like Star Wars-style battle almost with the amount of flak they must have been facing, just constant shooting at them. Can you tell us about that jump and the landing and what happened to some of these guys?
Yeah. The British officer, he was the chief air marshal named Sir Lee Trafford Mallory. He thought it was a terrible idea to use airborne behind Utah. He thought casualties would be between 75 and 80% of the men would be either killed or wounded. Now, he was wrong. It wasn't that high. It wasn't anywhere near that high. But that's how seriously they thought the obstacles they were facing were. And these 6,400 men of the 82nd Airborne, they followed the 101st that went first a half hour later in a sky train 150 miles long, I think 9 or 10 serials of about 40 planes with space in between them, 15 miles in between them. They started, they hit the west coast of France because they went around the back, not over the invasion beaches. They went around to the left side, the west side of the Cotentin Peninsula. They thought they could kind of sneak in, but after the 101st had landed first, they weren't going to sneak in. Anybody that was asleep was awake and shooting up at them. And everybody that survived said it was the wildest 4th of July fireworks they had ever seen. There were tracer bullets shooting everywhere and flak everywhere. It's amazing more of the planes weren't down, maybe 15 or 20 were. Ones that weren't, plus they hit a large fog bank, and they had to either go above the fog bank or below the fog bank. So that was kind of chaotic.
Wild.
When they came out of it a few minutes later, they were right over their drop zones, three drop zones, separated by a mile or two for three regiments. Most of the men were not dropped anywhere near their drop zones.
Yeah.
They dropped them sometimes so low. It was like 300 feet. They barely got out of the plane. Their parachute opened up and they had one swing and they hit the ground. Some men died because they were dropped too low, but most of them dropped. How chaotic the drop was is this tells you how chaotic it was. 24 hours later, on the morning of June 7th, they only had about a third, maybe 2,000 men under their control. The other men were trapped in different areas, mostly on the west side of the Murderay River.
That is just
very chaotic. And of course, a lot of these men, you know, there's about 18 men in what they called a stick. In every C-47, they call it this group of parachutists a stick. They're jumping out, you know, takes like 5 seconds for them all to jump out right one behind each other. But as they float to the ground, you never know where everybody is and it's dark. Some of the men rolled up. The first guy is supposed to turn around and move towards the middle. The last guy moves towards the middle. So ideally they all meet up,
sure,
you know, right in the middle, but that didn't always happen. So there were thousands of men all over this Cotentin Peninsula, and sometimes alone, sometimes with a buddy, sometimes with small groups.
Or like into fire or something like that, like burning and they land.
And of course there were German, you know, German squads and smaller groups, hundreds of them all over the Cotentin Peninsula in the countryside, dug in, waiting for them. Now, one good thing about how chaotic the drops were was that it kind of confused the Germans too. They didn't know where to go. They had reports of men dropping everywhere, so they couldn't gather like large numbers of them, large units, and send them out, you know, to this place or this place, because they didn't know where the attack was really located or centrally, you know, aimed.
Yeah. And what was that that letter that Eisenhower had written, like, just in case the landings failed? That was kind of haunting to read in your books.
Yeah, he had it written just in case. You know, in retrospect, of course, we think the, you know, D-Day was going to be successful from the very beginning, but that wasn't the case at all. The Atlantic Wall, which is what, you know, the Germans and Hitler called it, Atlantic Wall, Wall, which, you know, ranged from Norway, 2,200 miles down the coastline towards to Spain. It was fortified by something like 59 or 60 German divisions, and those were about 10,000 or so men. Strong points of, you know, there were a million mines, I think, more than a million mines. There were several million mines. There were, you know, gun emplacements. We've seen these photos of the huge concrete gun emplacements headed out to the sea. Now, the thing is, that's a little deceiving, because those strong points weren't everywhere. They just couldn't be over 2,200 miles, but there were a lot of them. And they also had obstacles on the beach, like those huge, you know, things that looked like huge jacks, you know, and mines and obstacles on the beach. And anyway, you know, it wasn't a sure thing at all. And he had written a very short message saying, you know, the invasion was not a success. The fault is all mine. He was ready for that because it wasn't a sure thing at all.
Goosebumps. Every time I think about it, it's just so haunting to think about that could have been the letter that was true.
Right. And, you know, if that invasion had failed, there wouldn't have been another for a long time, maybe never.
Yeah.
And that might have meant that there might be a negotiated peace. Meaning, or if there was a negotiated peace, and you know, who knows how long the war would have gone on? They could have sent. They were, of course, Russia was attacking Germany on the Eastern Front, and they were making inroads. But Germany could have sent a lot of those 60 divisions toward the Eastern Front to, you know, bolster their.
Like, who really knows?
The left side. Who knows how long it could have been? Plus, they had all these Wunderwaffen, these wonder weapons that were being developed, like the V-1, the V-2, jet airplanes, superior U-boats, were working on nuclear weapons, and who knows?
Kidnappings of scientists to try to, like, get nuclear weapons built, like each country was trying to, like, get the scientists.
Right, you know, the Manhattan Project was a race against the Germans. And, you know, in retrospect, we had the superior technology and scientists. But, you know, we didn't know that at the time. And so if this had not succeeded, who knows how long this would have gone, how many millions more deaths, civilian, military, would have happened. You know, by the spring of 1944, by May 1944, the Russians, I think, the total deaths was 15 million.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it would eventually go to 27 million Soviets, Russians die in the war. Makes ours look paltry in comparison.
Like, we have, what, like half a million or something like that?
And, yeah, something like 600,000, something like that. A lot, but Russia. So, you know, who knows how long this would have gone on? So it had to succeed, and they thought that the airborne and was necessary. Eventually it did succeed, but it wasn't easy because it took 3 days to take that one bridge, the bridge at Luffy.
And so the casualty rate was something like what, like 50-something or around 60 maybe?
50% eventually of the 82nd Airborne, because ideally, airborne doctrine, when the job is done, you know, they're kind of shock troops. They're dropped somewhere, They need to like take something, see something, you know, swift attack. And then when that's done, they're brought out, sent to, you know.
Yeah. You know, a lot of these guys were like Battle of the Bulge or like, you know, in Berlin or like,
yeah,
they're all over the place. I think some of them in the 82nd, you can find them in like multiple lives.
Yeah. Well, they were involved in the Bulge. But in this one, you're right. They did such a good job that the ground forces, the commanding generals of the ground forces, wanted them to stay there and be, you know, the tip of the spear in moving west to take the Cantentin Peninsula and choke it off so the Germans couldn't move north to, you know, keep us from taking Cherbourg. And they stayed there, I think, 33 days. And by the time they returned to England, there were some companies that were down to, I think one was down to 12 men out, you know, 60, 70, 80. Their stories in the end of the book, I recount a few of people, you know, watching them, and there's just nobody there. They had 50% casualties, which is very high.
Very high. And I mean, God, I love the title of your book. It really just sums up this feeling that you try to capture nothing but courage.
But I was lucky because I was struggling for a title, and there was a newsman. He worked for Time magazine, you know, that was big back then, Time and like Time Life. And he'd never jumped out of an airplane before, and with his little typewriter, and he stuck to one of the two commanding generals for the 82nd, the deputy commander, James Gavin, who's an extraordinary, one of the great commanders of the U.S. Army. And he was interviewed after the war, about 12 years later, by Cornelius Ryan, who was working on a book called The Longest Day, which was the first big book about D-Day.
Yeah.
And in one of the interviews, he said, "I saw nothing but courage."
Oh,
he said, "You saw it everywhere. It was everywhere. It was so common you didn't comment on it." And so as soon as I saw Nothing But Courage, that's the title of the book.
Hey, yeah. It's so like encapsulates this feeling of trying to like imagine, like what? There's a part of your book that was about, you know, they would follow their commander into the pit of hell if you said so. And like these guys, knowing that it was considered kind of like a death trap,
and you mentioned, I mean, they had a few things going for them. I mean, they were, you know, dropping into some might say some insurmountable problems, but their leadership was extraordinary. The commander of the 82nd was a man named Matthew Ridgway. He was all Army all the way. His father had been an officer. They said when he sat on a chair, the chair straightened up. He was always at attention. And he was extraordinary. More than one person said he resembled a Roman general, a Roman, you know, centurion. Right. He was extraordinary. And of course, he went on after the war. In the Korean War, he pretty much saved our butts in Korea when he came in and won that. But his deputy commander was a man named James Gavin, who had been an orphan who had never finished high school. He went through 8 grades. You know, back then during the Depression, a lot of families, whether it was city or rural, they would let their kids go through 8 grades to learn the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And then they'd pull him out to help on the farm or in the family business or help support the family. He went through 8 grades. Then he had several jobs. When he was 17, he moved out from his adopted family because his mother used to abuse him.
Oh.
He took a train to New York. He was 17 and wandered around looking for a job. Finally, he tried to enlist. You couldn't enlist at 17 without your parents' permission. He didn't want to get that from them, but they figured out a way. They had a lawyer who said he had Gavin sign a paper that said he had adopted Gavin and he was his official parent and he could give him permission. And it was
God.
He joined the Army at 17 in the late 20s, and eventually got into West Point without a high school graduation, without having gone to high school. Very determined, smart guy.
Yeah.
And he graduated from there, you know, was in the Army for about 10 years, the peacetime Army. But once it came along, he was interested in the Germans had pioneered airborne troops.
Yeah.
And he was fascinating, became the expert, wrote the first manual on it. And he was a very soft-spoken man, good looking. He looked like somebody from a Western, you know. He had that one of those faces and didn't yell at people. He was very inspiring, and everybody knew he was a ranker, meaning, you know, he came from the enlisted ranks and as deputy commander, you know, general, men just, they, if there was one general commanding officer I've ever read about that men genuinely loved, it was James Gavin. I mean, they just loved him. They worshiped him. They would have followed him everywhere. They respected Ridgway, but they loved James Gavin, and he was just fearless, jumped out of planes hundreds of times.
How lucky we were to have him, so determined.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
How lucky we were to have him so determined to get into the Army, and that he made it. That's incredible.
You're right. He was just fantastic. He was a very intelligent man, by the way, and. He was, he went on later to be, he was a envoy to, I can't remember what country, but very smart guy, very polished. But it wasn't just the two generals there, their colonels and lieutenant colonels who, you know, commanded each of the regiments, the four regiments. Almost every one of them was extraordinary, an extraordinary leader, even in majors, captains, lieutenants. They all displayed bravery everywhere, even sergeants. And the thing is, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of the men, I mean, they just dropped in and they were alone. They found themselves alone. And they later went on, they felt like the only person in the world. They could hear, you know, battles being fought and explosions. And they were, you know, it was easy to just get terrified and not do anything. Yeah. We're trained. The airborne in World War II were elite forces like the SEALs or the special forces are now. Only the airborne and the Army Rangers. And they were trained. They were honed. Have you seen pictures of those guys running? They would often, it wasn't unusual for them to be dropped during training about 130 or 40 miles away, dropped from an airplane, and given a problem like seize a bridge or seize an area or something like that. In training, and then walk back to, you know, wherever they were, the, you know, fort or post in 3 days. I mean, they were in extraordinary shape, and they were taught to take initiative. If there were no, you know, high-ranking field officers, they were taught to take initiative and do something on their own, which wasn't always the case in, you know, the Army, where they were basically just, you know, conditioned to take orders.
I was going to ask about that, is that there is this reputation of in World War II, the 82nd Airborne, they were specifically trained to, like, here's a paperclip and a pen, you know, secure this, secure the keep. And, you know, they could do things. They were trained to not need somebody to command them then and there. And so were they cut off for a time from, am I remembering this correctly? They were cut off for a time from some of the command and they had to do some of this?
You know, they were dropped 5 to 7 or 8 miles inland, not near. Now, the 101st was dropped 2 or 3 miles inland. They did their job by early afternoon of D-Day. They had gained control of those four X's, and they had already linked up with the, I think it was the 4th Army that had landed at 6:30 in the morning on Utah Beach. They had linked up because they were close to them. But nobody in the 82nd had linked up until maybe 2 days later. That was only, that was not a huge link. I mean, it was not a lot of people. So they were on their own for a lot of time, for a long time, facing tanks, large weapons, mortar.
Yeah.
The Germans with their machine guns. Germans had at least twice as many machine guns per unit than we did, and their machine guns were fantastic. The NG-34 and 42 were portable. They were very accurate. They could shoot out 1,200 rounds a minute.
Wow.
So, you know, everybody hated the sound of, you know, those weapons. So they were up against, like I said, even 24 hours later, there were only about 2,000, maybe a third of the troops under control of Ridgeway and Gavin. And the others were kind of trapped in different areas behind the lines or trapped, surrounded by Germans.
And they had to take all this initiative to this is what we do. This is, you know, and just kind of, this is how that is incredible.
Some of those groups, especially three or four on the east side of the murder ray, they were not rescued until after we took the Lafayette Bridge on the morning of D+3, June 9th.
And this kind of story that really does change you, at least for me, it kind of D-Day, these guys in the 82nd, and a lot of the other teams as well, change the way you even think about the word courage. And it's really hard to even imagine the kind of person that could do these things.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's it. That's it, basically.
Well, yeah. And we keep on coming back to courage. And, you know, it wasn't like it was absent from other Army units. But in this, there were even more opportunities for courage because they were rarely part of one large unit of, you know, hundreds or thousands of men.
Yeah.
I mean, and they had to take the initiative and show courage to do what they did. There were so many in this story. I couldn't include all of them. There were just so many. And I may have put in too many of them in this story.
No, I don't think so.
I may have bloated it in the middle with too many tales of courage, but some of it's just extraordinary reading about it. And, you know,
Can you pick a story that, like, highlights courage in
this? Oh, gosh, I don't know.
If you could pick one. Yeah, I know.
But, you know, this, like, the bridge where they had to take this bridge by the morning. They had tried the night before. They had crossed the murder ray a couple of miles north with a battalion of men, about 400 or 500 men, glider troops, and that didn't go well. But so the next morning, they called for another battalion, three companies of glider troops, which had not seen much action at all, but they were the fresh troops, and they were ordered to run across that bridge straight. You know, it was almost like a shooting gallery with, you know, dozens of machine guns trained on them and mortar everywhere and machine gun emplacements. The man that led the first company was named Captain John Sauls. Very interesting man. Already had a degree in ceramic engineering.
He was
a smart guy, but he was a captain of Company G, and they hid behind this short, like about 4 or 5 foot wall, 15 yards from where the bridge began. Remember, this bridge is only about 50 or 60 feet long. It's not wide at all.
Big,
on each side, there's maybe a 3 foot concrete wall, 200-year-old bridge, maybe. But they had to take this, and he was ordered to jump out. And when the time came, he put up his hand and said, "Let's go." And a machine gun round ripped right through his hand, and fortunately didn't hit any bone. But of course, you know, took out some of his hand, and he ran across the bridge, followed by his company, more than 100 men, and weaving their way through wrecked tanks, at least three German tanks and one troop carrier that were on the road on the other side of the bridge, and just kept on running 600 yards, sometimes past and placed Germans shooting at them to the other side. And somehow most of the men made it. They just put their heads up and ran as fast as they could. And men dropped here and there because the causeway that went on beyond the bridge was, just a road with some water on the side because the fields had been flooded. So there was just water on each side, maybe 15 yards wide, and that was it. But, it was everywhere. As this reporter said, I saw nothing but courage, and it was everywhere. Nobody commented on it because it was so common.
Good Lord. That is just wild. Do you think that the men from the 82nd would be surprised that even now, all the way forward to today, we still remember them for what they did?
Well, for the 82nd Airborne now, I talked to men there and in the 82nd Airborne who are, they're very proud of that. That bridge and that causeway is hallowed ground to them. And every D-Day week, the week preceding, June 6th, right about now, lots of them visit it, usually with some veterans. And they did that for years and years and years. But, this is the 81st. And anybody that's a veteran of World War II is 99, 100, 101, and there's just not many of them left. I don't know if any of them are going to be there this year, but there will be men from the 82nd. They usually do an honorary parachute jump, to commemorate it and everything. But there's a statue there called Iron Mike. And, I spent several days walking around there, and after reading hundreds of books and articles and interviews about it, seeing where it really happened was very impressive.
Yeah, I can imagine. I just have to say how hard it is to imagine having the kind of courage that these men had. It's almost impossible to imagine. And so I want to thank you for doing all of this research and writing it down so that we can remember and we don't forget what happened.
Thanks. It took me about 4.5 years to write this research and write it, which is longer than we were in World War II, by the way, the United States. But it was an honor. These men, my father was, he was deaf in one ear, and no service would take him because he was deaf in one ear. So he was in the Merchant Marine during the war. And the Greatest Generation, they're called that for a reason. And these men were my heroes. So reading about these, I actually got to interview a dozen of them who were in the 82nd.
Really?
Yes, I did. And I think every one of them is gone now. I did it about three years ago.
Oh.
And that was an honor, a great honor.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions and talking about everything. James Donovan, author of Nothing But Courage, The 82nd Airborne's Daring D-Day Mission and Their Heroic Charge Across the Lafayette Bridge. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Emily. This was a pleasure.
Happy flight.